You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There is a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for December 20th, 2013. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from our box seats at the Republican Civil War Holiday Extravaganza, it's the Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal.
Did Boehner find his nutsack or something? Or
no, come on. It's funny because it's inevitable, so you can laugh at things that...
Except it makes me kind of sick because they're playing with people's lives all the while.
Oh, they are.
Having an infighting over who controls the party.
No, but
his excuse is pathetic.
His attempt to reassert his manhood, essentially, by saying, the older boys made me do it. They made me eat poo. I didn't want to eat poo, but they made me do it. Dude,
and
you're the Speaker of the House.
And then they said it wasn't going to work. Yeah, and then they said it wasn't going to work. Are you kidding me? Yeah, okay.
And then they said
you made us shut down the government. You made us shut down the government. Wow.
Yeah, and again, you are the third in line to the presidency.
Yeah, yeah.
You are your office is named in the Constitution. You are elected by your party to run the House.
Mm-hmm.
And you're telling me that a minority of a minority made you eat poo and you didn't want to, but the older boys made me do it. And you just couldn't stop them. Mm-hmm. And you knew it would not end well, but you went along with it anyway because it wasn't your idea. That is such a pussy move. I mean, it really is it is absolutely handing your balls over to the shredder.
Yep.
So you know what? They took them away. Just keep them because I am such a incompetent, spineless loser. I let lunatics like Louis Gohmert push me around. And I knew better, but screw it. I was kind of drunk and I was crying. And Dude, if you don't want the job, don't take the job.
Yep.
And meanwhile, you got to imagine Nancy Pelosi is just, you know, sipping his tears with her pinky extended, mm-hmm. going, mm-hmm. geez, Boehner, I really feel sorry for you there, my man. And so his last minute Hail Mary thing was, they made me do it and they're crazy and out of control. And someone should certainly stop this. Someone should break this fight up. That someone was you, and it should have been broken up 20 years ago. And now it's too late. So you get to suck on it. The flip side of the funny part of watching a grown man in the third most, arguably the third most powerful constitutional position in the government, cry about being beaten up by Louis Gohmert is the tragedy that they are, in fact, just destroying people's lives and mm-hmm. wrecking this country and really mm-hmm. breaking things that are going to take a long time to fix.
Yeah.
So activism is what we do.
Mm-hmm.
Laughing is how we keep from...
how we cope, yes.
screaming and pounding our heads into pulp. It's been a weird week.
We did, but we had a good week. It was a weird week with stuff going on, but...
It was a week of highs and lows.
Like needing a brake job on the trusted old minivan.
Suddenly,
my brakes weren't working.
Hey, look, it's snowing outside and my brakes aren't working.
Yeah, that's... really that bad. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But fortunately, we have a good mechanic.
Yeah.
Saw me right away.
Yep.
Said, I really hate to tell you this, Fran. It's going to cost you over $500 to get this fixed. But
yeah, I blame the cats. I think the cats were out there fiddling with the emergency brake.
I blame the fact that the van is almost as old as our youngest child.
Okay.
It has more miles on it than we owe on our mortgage.
Yes. Well, there's that. teenage boy, because he was...
He was jamming the brakes. He's learning to drive.
So I think we should load this on his shoulders and say, you know, I think you should know you destroyed the van.
Broke the van.
Therefore, your driving privileges are revoked.
Oh.
It was just one of those things. Just old and fell time to fall down.
Yep.
But Christmas pageantry... singing,
oh, yeah, that's right.
Dancing. There was performance art.
Chimes.
There was
little tiny kids in halos going, "Hi, JoJo!"
who were hilarious.
From the stage. Oh my
God. Who were hilarious. I mean, Art Linkletter somewhere smiling because this is one of them was, this is in front of an
audience packed, of 300 people. Yeah.
Packed church, packed. There's all these little itty bitty tiny people up front doing their singing and dancing. And there was one, there was two,
there were three little angels. Yeah.
And one of them, and there's a crying room above, yes, above the sanctuary in the rear and above.
With glass windows so that whoever's up there with the crying baby can still participate in the service. Yes.
So this is the spot you all remember from The Graduate.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Where Dustin Hoffman stands banging the glass and screaming. Yeah. And apparently some little person's grandparent was up there. Yes. And so he kept pointing and going, I can see him. Right, he's like a full screen TV with grandpa on it.
And what was so funny was there was someone who was clearly 4 months older than that child.
It was deeply into character, into the performance. We don't break the fourth wall, you moron.
He was doing the headbang against his fist over and over again.
He literally
put
his hand,
such an idiot.
His face in his hands and looked like he was going to weep.
He's ruining it.
He's destroying Christmas for everyone. And the two of them together was just freaking priceless. So it was a very... again, a lot of highs and lows this week, a lot of ups and downs, and a lot of this is last week of full week of school for people. So hours are now tangled up and people are cranking on field trips and homework and basically a whole bunch of stuff I had no idea would be part of my life 5 years ago.
Yep.
So it's been a fascinating week, interesting week, busy, busy week. And
stepdad, I need $2.
$2.
The bus to go on the bus for the science field trip.
Where was that $2 I gave you a year ago? Oh, you spent that on ice cream. That's right. You know, when I was a kid, we didn't have ice cream.
We walked to our field trip when I was a kid. Yeah.
We made snow cones from the blizzard along the way and sold them for money.
All right. Well, we did Science Fiction University and recorded that before we recorded this podcast. And you tantalized me.
I did.
Although it's not going to be tantalizing for our listeners because they will have heard this segment of our show.
So,
we are crossing the streams, folks. You said that after writing two of the worst columns practically in recent memory.
Yeah.
You wanted to ask if David Brooks is a Robert Heinlein character.
Yes, especially his latest column, which everyone is, except for a few of us who understand David Brooks.
Yeah, are scratching their heads over.
Can't figure out who he's mad at.
Yeah, and it's about character leaders or...
Thought leaders.
Thought leaders.
Except it's mocking thought leaders as basically pretentious...
But isn't he a thought leader?
That's the point.
Trying to figure out is...
So David Brooks doesn't read comments of his own column. He doesn't respond to emails that you send him, but he in no way interacts with people who are reacting to what he writes at all.
Mm-hmm.
He only interacts with people like David Brooks. Mm-hmm. He lives in a bubble. He likes his bubble. And now his bubble is turning to ash all around him, and he's very angry. So he took the opportunity to lash out really viciously about everyone who's on the career track to become David Brooks. And it was the most weirdly self-loathing column I've seen him write in a long time.
Mm.
He mocks his own self, except he doesn't name anybody. He just invents this amorphous category of thought leader and then just starts taking pot shots at everyone within range. And he wrote another column a long, long time ago, trashing his own profession, about how sad it makes people who only make $185,000 a year to realize that this reporter over here makes $800,000 a year. And this sort of status competition between him and Cokie Roberts and David Broder and people who are all in the bubble with him. He wrote that in 1996. He has made a conscious decision to become this awful person. Now he comes to his 50s. And in his 50s, his wife has left him.
Yep.
He is disrespected by the people who are coming for his job. And this is what's creepy about his column. He is so obsessed with not ever mentioning personal confrontations of any kind, not ever personalizing anything, not taking any position on anything, that you can't figure out what he's writing about, because he won't say this is about Barack Obama or this is about Paul Krugman or this is about me or this is about my students. He just makes up these abstract categories of types of people that he knows and you've never heard of and then mocks them as if you had any idea what the hell he's talking about.
Yeah.
So the thing that makes it a that might make it a Robert Heinlein story is here's this guy at the essentially ass end of his career.
Yeah.
With everything he's ever wished for. He's got his mansion. He can go anywhere in the world he wants. He can take a 3-month book leave and do nothing. He gets to go on PBS anytime he wants. He gets to go on Meet the Press. He gets to call anybody on earth and get an interview. He has actual power, actual influence. He's very rich. Mm-hmm. And he has insulated himself from any accountability for anything he says or does. That's the thing that makes me laugh when I read Alex Perrine.
Yeah.
Or Charlie Pierce or me. We're all good writers, and the profession of deconstructing and mocking David Brooks has become a high art. But it will never affect him, because the billionaires who protect him from any accountability don't care about what we have to say. So he is completely insulated. He has absolute access to anyone on earth he wants. He has all the money he'll ever need. And now his wife has left him.
Or he left his wife. We don't know. We don't know the details.
And he's made a career writing about how poor people are doomed.
Can't have stable marriages.
Because of that's the reason they're poor. They have unstable marriages.
Yeah.
And they have unapproved, David Brooks unapproved sexy time with each other.
Yep.
And he's written this long career of moralizing about, for example, moralizing about how poor people should behave to save their marriage, and his marriage is over. He's written this long call. He's written a lot about how limits should be placed on presidential power, and then writes a column about how we should give the president more power. He wrote endlessly
about that. What was so weird to me about that column?
Yeah,
was he really doesn't get how often and how quickly he contradicts himself?
Because nobody points it out to him.
Yeah.
Because there's nobody, literally, there's no one in his circle of friends, no one in his circle of acquaintances. And that is an absolutely common theme among all Washington pundits. There is no one in there. There is no, the emperor has no clothes, little boy or little girl in the room to say, but that's bullshit.
And that just directly contradicts something you said weeks ago, not years ago. I mean,
they have, by common agreement,
contradicts themselves from 5 years ago when they were writing about Bush, and now they're writing about Obama, and they say something different. You might say, okay, maybe you forgot that you said that, or maybe you have different circumstances, but it's same White House, same president, same
year,
same season.
And you flip it around. Or it wasn't one column. It was your entire leitmotif. It was your entire genre you invented that you now disavow and pretend you never wrote.
Yep.
And it's that pile of work that you did while you're working for Bill Kristol that got you your New York Times column.
Yep.
That got you all the access and all the power and all the money, et cetera. And you're now spending your time shredding your younger self and disavowing anything you ever said before and talking about the essential uselessness of your own profession. And all you need to do is add in a scientist buddy. And he does have access to a lot of neurobiologists and neuroscientists, sort of a crackpot fringe scientist who has what he thinks might be a time machine. And you get, get David Brooks over at this guy's house, sitting around their glove leather, hand-stitched chair in front of the roaring fire, talking about how things might have been, how things could have been in the past, and a couple, three brandies and four brandies later, and he's a little lubricated. And you put him in a time machine, and you send him back to the University of Chicago, circa 1979, 1980, where he either loathes his younger self so much that he gives him the very advice that destroys him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Marry this girl over here and give up this whole history studying shit. Go write an essay for Bill Buckley. In fact, I'll give you the outline for it. It'll totally make your life easy peasy. Or he mistakes young pimple-faced David Brooks for another grabby, greasy, careerist climber and just mocks him.
And that's why he's a Robert Heinlein character?
Well, he goes back in time and, thinking to save himself, he finds some other dupe to convince to become this person. He says, kid, I got some advice for you. There's a guy named Bill Buckley coming to campus. Write this story and he'll give you a job. Do this and this and this. And it turns out in the end that he's actually talking to himself. He's just too drunk to realize it. But David Brooks, if you add in the arc of time travel, going back to his own youth and either misdirecting his younger self out of bitterness or drunkenness or not recognizing his younger self. Heinlein does that a lot. You see people who are familiar to you, but you're not quite sure who they are. He's got a story called All You Zombies, where the main character is a hermaphrodite. who has a gender change, goes back in time, impregnates his younger female self, has a child that grows up to be him, and thus creates the universe. And there's another one called By His Bootstraps, which is, it's all the same character from various points in the future who come back to say, quick, do this thing. And then there's another one who comes back and punches the other one and says, don't listen to that guy. And then the phone rings and it's a very familiar voice. And then an old man shows up and it's all the same character.
Mm.
It's all the same character triggering the events that cause the character to become who he is.
Mm-hmm.
And he's trapped in this temporal loop, this causal loop. And the idea that David Brooks is spending the end of his career mocking his younger self, hating his younger self.
Yeah,
you know, sort of looking back through a couple of glasses of brandy at the marriage.
It's a Greek tragedy. It really is. Yeah. I'm going to change the subject slightly. Did David Brooks make our favorite end of year list with Alex Perrine?
Yes, he did. Yes. Alex Perrine, by the way,
number one.
No, Mike Allen's number one.
Oh.
And Alex Perrine stepped it up this year.
Yeah.
His hack list, which is recommended reading for everyone. Alex Perrine writes a top 10 media hacks every year, which is hard work and difficult to stomach. And as he points out in his own hack list, it's hard to find something new to say about Tom Friedman, for example, who's written about 100 times already. So this year he has, and as a writer who has done stories in the throes of character possession, writing the story as that character, he's written each of his hack stories as the principal character might have written it.
Mm-hmm.
So he's written his takedown of Tom Friedman.
It's about Tom Friedman. Yes. It's
in the voice of Tom Friedman. He's written it as Alex Perrine in the voice of Tom Friedman,
wow,
who is wandering through the park looking for inspiration because he's written about this so many times before. And he happens across a young Pakistani who says, you remind me of Tom Friedman. And it's wonderful. Some of them are good. Some of them are just brilliant. But he really, it's a tour de force. It's hard enough to do this thing that he does every year, but to do it in the voice of the characters that you're mocking is a, you know, somebody needs to give that young man a much wider exposure because he's a very good writer. But yeah, his number one on his hack list is Mike Allen.
Because
Mike Allen runs Politico.
Mm-hmm.
And this is very much in the same vein as, why doesn't anybody ever tell David Brooks that he is making an ass of himself,
mm-hmm,
that he's contradicting things? He has to know it. I mean, and a brief aside, I was there at the one public event where someone did that.
Mm-hmm.
I have it on film.
He whitewashed it.
He just said, I never said that.
Yep.
I don't believe I ever said that. And he went right on with his speech. Because in the world in which he travels, no one ever holds each other accountable for anything. It is the Confederacy of Dunces. It is, you know, if one of us starts measuring the honesty of the other, this entire den of thieves falls apart because we're all liars and we're all corrupt.
But so why is Mike Allen on? I mean, I understand Politico is hacks, but what's the deal with Mike
Allen?
Why is he number one?
Mike Allen has turned Politico, which is a tip sheet, which is the indispensable Washington Beltway elite tip sheet, which inexplicably mentions Joe Scarborough every three paragraphs.
and Joe Scarborough then has them on his show.
Exactly. It's this incestuous, mutually beneficial financial relationship. Mike Allen essentially writes fluff pieces for his advertisers and passes them off as news.
Wow.
He takes money in the form of advertising. We're somewhere in the neighborhood of $35,000 a week, $1.8 million a year from advertisers, which his John Vanderhye says that doesn't constitute bribery. He's not taking money for promoting these people's political interests. Oh, that is exactly what he's doing. And now it's an open secret that Mike Allen takes money from politicians, from PACs, from not-for-profits that corporations that sponsor him promote, from special interest groups to promote their particular point of view, to write positively, glowingly, advertising ready, sometimes just taking press releases and putting them out as news.
Yeah.
For money.
Yep.
And the thing that makes it so hilarious is nobody is willing to stand up other than, you know, outsider bloggers and nefarious
and Alex Perrine. Yep.
People like that. Alex Perrine, I'll give Andrew Sullivan credit. He has done it. Mm-hmm. Charles Pierce, but nobody inside the Beltway bubble has stood up and said, Mike Allen, you're lying. This is payola.
Yeah.
This is absolutely taking money from your advertisers to promote their crappy mm-hmm. products as mm-hmm. if you were reporting on straight news to an audience that you've built precisely to get access to the most influential, powerful, and rich people in Washington.
Right.
And he does it unashamedly, on purpose. It is his business model. And the reaction has been...
There's a ton of money in it.
God, yes. I mean, millions and millions, tens of millions of dollars flowing into his pockets for him.
You know how long it takes this podcast that people are listening to right now to make $35,000?
Yeah, long time. A year and a half.
More than that. Yeah, longer.
A couple of years. And in 1 week...
2 or 3 years, yeah.
And in 1 week, by selling, by literally...
And he gets that every month?
Per advertiser.
I have to do the math.
I think it's per week.
Oh my God.
Because 35 would be 300,000. No, it's 1.8 million or 1.7 million, according to the article I read, per year. So that comes to 30 whatever per week. Per week. That
And we learned that Joe Scarborough makes three times that.
Yeah. And this is money being paid to them by corporations, mm-hmm. by big political mm-hmm. donors, by mm-hmm. political people, by political PACs to repackage their shitty spinning press releases mm-hmm. as hard insider news that you need to know to get by in this jungle that is Washington, D.C. It is absolute prostitution.
Yep.
Clear, upfront, and the reaction from the people who live in that world is nobody say nothing.
Yeah.
Everyone just shut up about it, sit on your hands, just whitewash it, stonewall it, and eventually it'll go away. Like Laura Logan.
Yeah, like Laura Logan. In relation to this, uh-huh. Josh Barrow has pointed out that this whole thing about Rand Paul being a plagiarist.
Yeah.
That these Beltway think tanks desperately want Rand Paul to plagiarize their press releases.
Absolutely.
You know, and you would never accuse Rand Paul of plagiarism for reading your press release out loud in a speech. You'd want him to do that. The Heritage Foundation wants every Republican to read Heritage Foundation press releases as if it's verbatim. Their own words.
Absolutely.
That's their job, is to make it sound like it's policy.
Exactly. And believe me, I've written enough speeches in my life.
I mean, you and I have written them, yes.
To turn policy language into conversation.
Yeah.
And there's art to it. And let me just say, first of all,
you're an advocate. There is nothing wrong with that.
No.
That is a real job. You are trying, you know, unions do this and AFI does this. And, you know, you write things so that they sound like a cohesive argument for what you want to have happen.
You're trying to feed your people ammunition in a fight.
Right.
And ammunition is policy and logic and evidence.
And it's a talent to be able to write that.
Yes,
and
it is.
Nothing there, that's not hack writing. That's advocacy writing.
But
even if you're a right winger, that's advocacy writing.
Exactly. But whole blocks of Wikipedia entries,
it's a little
calling
different.
Them your own, by the guy who is named after, or at least nicknamed after, who worships at the altar of a woman whose whole ideology is about the inherent evil in taking other people's stuff.
Stealing other people's work, yes.
It's just, this is such bad screenwriting.
Yeah.
But again, it goes unmentioned. That twist to it, didn't Ayn Rand call like worse than Hitler people who tax you, because taxing is expropriating your property involuntarily, and that is the worst evil you could ever do anywhere? How do you reconcile that with your fundamentalist Christianity, which she was an atheist? These are questions that if I were a reporter at that level, I would be asking. But the fact that I would be asking them means I will never be a reporter at that level, because you don't get to be within shouting distance, within question distance of Rand Paul or Mike Allen or David Brooks or David Gregory. If you come in, they have like a metal detector at the door. They detect if you're going to ask them any scary questions about their lying or their deceit or their incestuous relationships with each other. And if you're not going to ask any of those questions, maybe you can come in and talk for a while. And that's how it works.
So Laura Logan, as we have predicted, gets out of the Mark Halperin penalty box after less than 30 days. Because, you know, there's a limit. You can only stay in there 30 days. And then
it's called doing the full Halperin.
Doing the full Halperin.
Yeah.
And she's actually back at work now after lying.
Less than 30 days.
She's back at work producing stories. She's calling people and getting interviews and lining up stuff. But she's not back on the air yet. That'll happen in 30 days. 30 days.
Mark my words.
We got to talk about Obamacare. The ACA website worked for us this week. Yay! But we have kind of a funny story to tell about this.
We do. You tell the funny story. This is like a Bible bitch story.
It's almost a Bible bitch story.
It happened to us.
It did. As some of you know who've listened to the podcast.
Once upon a time.
Once upon a time.
Thank you.
Driftglass and I were on Medicaid. And this fall, the state of Illinois did a review of the Medicaid program and summarily kicked people off of Medicaid, adults, I will say. They did not kick children off of Medicaid, but they kicked adults off of Medicaid who were above a certain income level. And we were a little confused about that, but I called and found out.
We're above that income level by about $4.
Yeah, really. Yeah. We're above the income level within $1,000 for sure.
And we are very grateful to have income of any kind. So just so we're clear.
Seriously, we are above that income level. The cutoff for Illinois, we are above it by about $1,000 a year. And so I spoke to someone at the ACA phone number I spoke to someone at the Medicare office, Medicaid office. A gentleman, and I said, you know, I need to know, are we covered for this month or when does it cut off? Does it cut off January 1st? And he said, no, it cuts off October 31st.
Whoa.
But
happy birthday.
You should do really, really well on the exchanges.
Uh-huh.
And I said, thank you, and hung up. And the kids still have insurance. We have to pay a little bit every month for their insurance to be on Medicaid, but it's not much. And I'm so grateful that because they have special needs and medications and so forth, that they are covered. And that is apparently, you know, as guaranteed as the state can guarantee it until they're 18. So and the state of Illinois, to its credit, has embraced Obamacare, has embraced the federal website.
Right. As a favor.
As a sort of a favor to the administration, because Obama is from here. And they've had Kathleen Sebelius in the governor's making press conferences and talking about innovation and how can we tweak things and can we use this as a guinea pig and can we do these things and really being on the side of Sebelius and Obama.
Just so we're clear, we don't have an Illinois exchange, not because we have a Republican governor who said, screw that, we're not going to cooperate.
No.
We have a Democratic governor
who
said, make us the laboratory for your experiment.
Make us the ones that make this work.
Early adopter.
Let Illinois be the, you know, plate glass window with the display of how Obamacare can work.
Yes.
And so being kicked off of Medicaid and so forth, then we had the problems with the website.
Yes.
And being a web person, I kind of wanted to wait it out and make sure that we did it on the webs because that's so podcastable. This whole
thing
with Obamacare has been podcastable for us. We kept telling each other.
Oh, content.
And got some advice from some people and some good advice from some people who have been on the website that if you delete your whatever application you've been playing with while it hasn't been working, just delete it and start over. It goes through very smoothly. And it did. I also learned from a fellow blogger that you should put in, they expect you to put in as a self-employed person, your net income, not your gross income on the website, that if you should deduct your business expenses. So that reduces our income a little bit.
The cost of all that porn is now just right off.
No, but computer repair and a couple of other things are deductibles.
Yeah.
We do take care of that. So went through the process and it was very quick. I did it in less than an hour, you know, filled it out and clicked send. And literally, you know, Joe Biden, literally within a minute, the little clock went around and said, here's your results. You have to download them as a PDF and you have to read them that way because it's private. But I did that. And there is this letter of eligibility and says, you're eligible for Medicaid.
What? Well, that's fantastic. I've heard good things about that program.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
Yeah. Can I just mention that everyone that we dealt with, everyone that you dealt with, was helpful and knowledgeable and really...
Yeah, and this Dick congressman that we all know,
uh-huh.
Daryl Issa, who's now going after the navigators.
Right.
There are just times, Driftglass, never in the course of thinking about our marriage, but in the course of blogging, that I really wish I was a guy.
Yeah.
I could tell him to suck my dick.
The navigators for Obamacare are the research librarians of Obamacare.
Yeah. Well, and they've been everyone who's done this sort of thing for other programs.
Everyone.
It's so ridiculous.
Every social service
program. The farm bill has navigators with it.
Go to your local employment office or workforce. Yeah. You'll find someone there who will help you. Go to your library. Again, this is the friendly librarian who's there to help you navigate through and find what you need to find. Yeah. And Daryl Issa.
You're in hospital or you don't know the internet or you're old or you're blind or you're whatever. You just need help. They'll help you.
And Daryl Issa is the leader of the torch-wielding mob outside who wants to burn the library down.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. So I called after I got this letter. The first thing that occurred to me as we discussed it was, this is podcastable.
Yeah.
The second thing that occurred to me was, look, we are being transferred from state money to federal money.
Yes.
It's obvious that what they're doing is cutting us off a few months ahead of time. First of all, so that we can be quote unquote uninsured, and then we're a plus sign on the governor's list of he got insurance for an uninsured person.
Yep.
And there is a place on the Illinois application for Medicaid that says if you need help for the past 3 months, we'll backdate it.
Yeah. Huh.
And, which I wish they would have told us before I got your inhaler.
Yeah.
And paid the uninsured price of $50 instead of the insured price of $3 for asthma inhaler. But, you know, that's the way that goes. But anyway, I talked to the people at the Illinois, you will not believe this, the Illinois ACA help desk.
Yes.
They have a help desk that is simply there to help you find the right person to talk to.
Yes.
And she said that to me. She said, look, I'm not here to help you get Medicaid, but I can put you in touch with the Medicaid office. I can put you in touch with social services if you need other help and so forth. I said, no. And I said to her on the help desk, it seems to me that we're being moved from state money to federal money. And she just immediately said, yes, you are.
Yeah. Yep.
So, and she said, you're not the only one. There are lots of people that this is happening to. Now, again, I'm in good shape. You and I are in fairly good health.
Yeah.
God forbid we should get in a car accident in the next 3 weeks, but we're okay. And you and I are not on any other prescriptions other than your asthma. So I feel horrible for those people that got kicked off of Medicaid who might not be taking their medications right now because they don't have
insurance. And who didn't know what to do.
And didn't know what to do and weren't told. And that, you know, you and I are savvy enough to know how government works.
Yep.
That we figured that by January 1st, we'd be covered again by something.
And persistent enough and having.
And persistent enough, have lots of skills.
We have. Exactly. We have people we can call on who are website designers. Here's what you should do.
So then I called the Medicaid office and asked her, because it seemed to me that the ACA website was hinting that because I'm eligible for Medicaid, that the website was in essence constituting an application for Medicaid, that because I'd filled out all this information and was eligible, that this constituted an application for Medicaid and that I wouldn't have to do anything. I would hear from them. Ha ha. So I called the Medicaid office through the help desk. They gave me the Medicaid office number and talked to another very nice person and said, does this constitute an application for Medicaid? And she said, well, it's supposed to.
Yep.
If I were you,
yeah,
I would go ahead and fill out a paper application and get it in the mail because it'll help.
I don't want to tell you what to do, but a wink is as good as a nod to a blind bat.
And I said, and I also assume, am I right in assuming that I'm being moved from state money to federal money? And she said, yes, you are. And I said, I mean, her eyebrows are up because she realizes she's talking to somebody who's not unknowledgeable about it.
And who's not freaking out.
No, and I'm not freaking out. I'm not mad at her about it.
No.
And so I said, and the governor's going to get points because I'm quote unquote uninsured, right?
Right.
She laughed so hard. She's like, yeah, you're going to be considered an uninsured person who got Medicaid through ACA.
Yep.
Yeah.
We did a delete add instead of change precisely because.
Add so that we could count you as uninsured.
Yep. And I guarantee you somewhere, and I know this from direct experience, somewhere out there is a list of numbers they have to make.
Yep.
And it is an unfortunate but predictable reality with all bureaucracies. Mm-hmm. Whenever you set thresholds, people will organize themselves around meeting those thresholds by whatever means necessary.
That's their job. Yeah.
Now, Enron, they had an HR system that encouraged people to sabotage each other, stab each other in the back, lie, make numbers up, bullshit people, which succeeded in making a few people very rich and destroying the company. But they did it because they were being rewarded for doing so. Yep. So in every social service agency I have ever heard of or worked with or worked for, you have a strategy involved in not helping everyone because you can't. Trying to help the people most in need.
It's triage. It's absolute triage.
And you balance out the people that you got into the business to help, the really needy, with some easy layups. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you can make your numbers.
Right.
And so there are always strategies involved in every organization that are, look, we need to hit this number. How about we just delete them and add them? Mm-hmm. Would that count? Well, I guess technically, yeah, that would.
These are not deleting, adding people who are below the threshold for state Medicaid at all.
Right.
This is cleaning out the system of people whose income is a little higher. And also they kicked a lot of people off who, to tell you the truth, had moved out of Illinois and were still on Medicaid through Illinois. And that's just cleaning up the numbers and making sure people don't, you know, people move to Gary, Indiana for low housing and come back and go to the doctor in Chicago because they've got Illinois Medicaid and they never switched it.
Sure.
And, you know, you have to switch it.
Look, and if you're one of the three conservatives listening to this show, this is the government you want. Mm-hmm. You want people who work for you for tax, who make a living working
off of
for
your
you
tax dollars
to have measurable, recordable,
success,
justifiable outcomes.
And to be looking for incorrect applications and filtering out those people who do not belong in a certain system.
Absolutely.
You want that.
And
you want it to work that way.
And you want to be able to sit them down once a month, which happens a lot, or at least once a quarter or once a year, and say, okay, here's what we contracted you to do. Mm-hmm. Here's what you delivered. Here are the places where you did well. Here's where you did poorly. Rather than beating you up with a hammer once a year, let's sit down once a month and go over what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
This is a natural bulge, and we always know that we have renewals in February and June.
We know we have more teenagers looking for jobs in June than we do in February.
So that's
why we need to have a program in the summer to make sure those kids are taken care of.
And that's
why you have summer jobs programs instead of Valentine's Day job programs.
And that's why we've held these positions open. That's why we've asked for extra funding.
Right.
That's why
we look to the Park Service for funding. And that's why we do X, Y, and Z to make sure we have it all in a row. Yeah.
And those numbers will drop in September when they go back to school.
Back to school. Exactly.
So if you understand the natural ebb and flow of human behavior and you try to build social systems to help people, you really do want them to have checkpoints along the way that they're just going to naturally try to strive to meet by whatever means necessary. And then you tweak those, you adjust those so that the good people who go into public service get to help the people they went into public service to help.
In the end, I filled out a paper application for Medicaid, and I'm actually going to drive it over to the Medicaid office because I know where they are.
I know where you live.
And then I watch the lady stamp it in with a date, and then it has a timeline by which it has to get answered. So that I like that. So there you go. And now you had a good email from Arliss Bunny, who has written a book. Arliss Bunny is author of The Smart Bunny's Guide to Debt, Deficit, and Austerity. Driftglass, she wrote to you.
Did. Well, left a comment, long comment.
Long comment at your blog.
I had the unemployed and underemployed, the plight of the unemployed and...
Which is getting worse.
The cutoff of long-term unemployment for the people who've exceeded their limit is coming shortly after Christmas, and nobody can stop it.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's a horrible idea, it's sadistic, it is stupid, and it's just stupid for a lot of reasons. It's stupid because people with but I am long-term underemployed.
Yes.
So
since 2008.
Yes. And I, believe me, I understand. I have mastered labor market information. Part of my punishment for my, I don't know what, something I did in a previous life, is that I know so much about labor markets and about reemployment statistics and about sectoral economic development that I know exactly how bad off I am.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, I'm the doctor who knows exactly what's wrong and is not cheered by the fact that, oh, no, I'm sure it's just a cold. No, no, I know exactly what it is, and it's not a cold. That being said, there are things that we as a country and we as a culture and we as a government could do that's just in our own self-interest. Mm-hmm. There are millions of people with excellent skills that their skills are rotting on the vine because they're not being used. There's all this untapped human potential that's just sitting there simply for want of a place to go and employ that to do work, to do something productive. These are not people who are lazy. They're not people who are stupid. They're not people who are morally defective. These are people, a lot of whom are my age or a little bit younger or a little bit older, who are considered unemployable because mm-hmm. they are unemployed.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no profit in hiring someone who's in their 40s and 50s and knows how the world works and knows how has experience and knows how to learn quickly and wants to work, when it's just easier to hire someone in their 20s to push a button,
mm-hmm.
not think. And the people in their 20s and 30s are getting screwed because there's no place for them to go. There's no career ladder for them to rise up through because all the people who still have jobs and should have started exiting the job market are hanging on to them for dear life.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this big bottleneck that could be solved with direct government employment and is never going to be. And mm-hmm. absent that, extending unemployment is the very, very least we can do, and we're just not going to do that either. We're going to punish people for being in the wrong place at the wrong time, and we're going to make it their fault. And we're going to hang it around their neck and call them unclean and unfit to be part of our society. And we're going to let them do all this in silence. We're not going to cover them. We're not going to go to their house and look and watch as their homes are repossessed and their possessions are tossed out in the street and their kids are sent away. We're going to just let all that happen quietly, far away, because everyone in Washington has a job.
Well, and I have, as I said on Twitter last night, in the past, waited 3 or 4 minutes for Rand Paul to say something either cruel or stupid.
Yeah.
And I'm finding you don't have to wait anymore. Yeah. He just opens his pie hole and starts being really nasty or idiotic. And in this case,
ideological. Both. It is.
Well, and what he said, and I was glad that the Chris Hayes show brought it up last night to say that what he said made no sense. He was playing that tired old canard that, you know, the reason we have to stop all this extended unemployment because people want to stay on unemployment forever and they'll never get a job if they just have a check coming to them every month.
Oh, yeah. That's just going to happen every single time.
Ezra Klein pointed out, excuse me, but one of the requirements for receiving unemployment benefits is you are continuing to look for a job.
Yes.
If you don't have that benefit coming to you, one of your motivations for looking for a job is removed. You aren't required, if you aren't getting a check, you're not required to go out looking and prove that you're looking to the unemployment office.
Nobody is getting rich on unemployment.
You can get, and no one is getting rich on unemployment.
I don't care what Sean Hannity told you. Sean Hannity's a liar. Yeah. Sean Hannity's a congenital pathological liar. Yep. So nobody's getting rich on unemployment. People, the maximum amount for unemployment you can collect in Illinois, I collected on a couple of occasions, not collecting it now, but I have collected, wasn't enough to really cover the assessment on my condo.
No.
And it was enough to cover that and maybe some groceries. But it was absolutely nowhere near enough to cover food, rent, transportation, mm-hmm. Anything like that. It is absolutely not enough to live on. It's enough to starve on. Mm-hmm. And part of the motivation for even getting that pittance is you have to look for a job. You have to document that you've looked for a job. You have to have people that if I work at the employment office and I call you up and audit you, which happens all the time.
Yeah.
You have to be able to produce documentation of who you've talked to, what jobs you've applied for, what the results were, who you spoke to, what the phone numbers are, and I will check up on all those things. And I will find out if you're lying to me. So this whole idea that, my cousin Jimmy knows a guy who didn't want to, and he just sees sitting on his fat ass, collecting unemployment, living the life, drinking beer, hot and cold, running hookers. That guy, slap that guy the next time you see him, because he is lying to you. And he has been lied to, and he's dumb enough to believe it, because that never happens. That just doesn't happen. What does happen is you show up at the employment office with your list of jobs that you've gone to, and they ask if they can help you. And usually they get kind of sorry for you, because I have been to the employment office many times. I've been there for reasons like getting my employment check, unemployment audit, but I also have gone there just to use their services, also to talk to them, talk to the people that work there, just to talk to them, find out what's going on in the labor market, what's happening in the local area, how are they doing. They're kind of a vital resource that goes under the radar. And you see 30, 40, 50-year-old men and women queued up out the door all the time, who are not lazy, who are not stupid, who are not morally defective. And you see the caseworkers and the frontline people empathizing with them, because they know there ain't no jobs out there.
Right.
However hard you look.
You've had people tell you that. Like, I know there's no jobs. Yeah.
And I mean, statistically, there's one applicant for every three jobs. I'm sorry, there's three applicants for every one job.
One job. Yep.
And it's a buyer, it's a seller's market. So the idea that if you just tried harder, if you just wore a better tie, if you just did X, Y, and Z, if you just understood the magic trick.
If you were just desperate enough and starving and had no money, you'd go out and find something.
Sure, you would.
Yeah.
What you need to do is suffer more. And then eventually you'll see the light and become the child of a wealthy politician like Rand Paul is.
Yeah, right.
And then you'll see the light. But Rand Paul's stuck because ideologically he cannot admit anything other than that. That is his true faith.
Right.
And if he ever admitted that this is just bullshit, there isn't enough work out there, all the money from all the productivity gains for the last 30 years, all the recovery money has gone to the top 1, 2 to 5% of this country. None of it's trickled down. None of it's gone where Reaganomics promised it would. It would be like admitting, you know, Jesus was this guy. Yeah. He wasn't the son of God. He never worked any miracles. Christianity's a fraud. It is that big a deal for someone like Rand Paul to admit the fact that it's staring him in the face. So he's never going to do it. He's just going to keep listening. He's going to keep allying himself with Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and all the other racists and assholes who want to keep you convinced that the reason you're broke is because brown people are stealing your money and poor people are poor because they're stupid and lazy.
And they're mooching. Yep.
And they're mooching.
They like mooching.
They live for it. Yep. So yep. I got this wonderful long – I did a post a couple of weeks ago that went over very well. Didn't make me a fortune, mind you, but but it was well received. And I had a chance to revisit it, and I got a comment from Ms. Bunny. I'm going to read that to you right now because I hauled it up out of the comment section and – made it a post because I thought it was very good. And this is, again, one of those areas where you can take action. There are places where labor and small business and liberal politics all touch in a mutually beneficial and advantageous way.
And where you can work with Republicans on the ground in your local neighborhood and get them to see your side of things. If you're not an ideologue, just want to get something done. It can happen.
It can. You can show them.
Their self-interest.
But this is very local. And she says, I've been meaning to write to you about this for some time. I'm an employer. I own a small manufacturing company. I have a different perspective. Our company has found that when we hire older employees, they require substantially less training, are generally vastly more reliable, have already established a strong work ethic, and bring with them all kinds of outside thinking and processes which have improved our productivity. Mm-hmm. We pay a living wage, health insurance, and full benefits package. In the last 3 months, we have filled 3 positions, and all of them with people who were long-term unemployed because, parenthesis, and I really cannot figure out why other employers can't figure this out, close parenthesis. The long-term unemployed are happy to have a good job and come to work every day, dying to make a difference and build the company. Mm-hmm. All the way around, it's a win-win deal. Now, I understand that my company is the exception, but I can't figure out why this is the case. Because we hire incredibly skilled, experienced people who show up every day with their brains engaged. Mm-hmm. We have been able to become dominant in our market, export more than 80% of what we build overseas, and soundly beat back foreign competition. Mm. As best I can tell, we have just been using common sense, entrepreneurial drive, and capitalism. Mm-hmm. Despite the fact that I'm a progressive, we have not been operating as a social service organization. We're a business, and our goal is to make money. Here's what I've been thinking lately, however. I think the Dems, as well as Netroots, DCOs, et cetera, need to speak to and organize small businesses. Small business never benefits from the austerity-based monetary policies of the GOP. I listen to progressive internet-based radio all day long. The professional left is my fave. And I have to say that the constant pounding by the left on, quote, business, unquote, and, quote, corporations, unquote, is off-putting. Yep. It's one thing for the left to be pounding on big business and big corporations. That is well-deserved and much needed. But when they are all grouped together, a serious opportunity is lost. Mm-hmm. When we, and by we, I mean progressives, fail to distinguish between my company and Boeing, we are failing in a variety of ways. We are failing to speak to a large group of voters. We are failing to dynamically promote and encourage best practices in a manner which will support the overall goals of the progressive movement. And we are failing to shine a light on and support those small companies who are doing right. Anyway, that's my two cents. I would love to hear your thoughts. And my thoughts were, I agree with you 100%.
Costco. You know, Costco is a company that pays a living wage, gives benefits, and treats their employees like human beings, and they succeed.
There is a way for progressives to talk about business. There's a way for progressives to talk about the economy that isn't about welfare and we want more of your money. Mind you, I'm a big proponent of social welfare programs, and I think the rich are grotesquely undertaxed. Mm-hmm. But like the Pope, it's a matter of emphasis. I think progressives would do very well to take my 7-part program, How to Talk to Small Business People, because I'm actually really good at this.
You should do a whole Glenn Beck thing with like a folder and
chalkboard
CDs
and glasses,
and chalkboard
and a bow tie,
the DVD set or the audiobook. You choose.
Now flip forward to chapter 3, the Trilateral Commission and you. Once you can engage a business owner, a small business owner is usually someone who started up a small company with their wife or their family or some partner who just wants to make enough money to pay for their house, go on vacation, and provide for their kids. They're not global transnational monsters. And what they lack, their impediments to growth are usually not regulatory or tax-based, although they will bitch about those all the time. But, you know, fine. You bitch about death and taxes. Who doesn't? But their real problem is that their schools suck. And their high school doesn't have a voc ed program anymore. And people at the community college don't have the money to buy the equipment to train the people they need to keep going. Their problem isn't big labor unions. Their problem is they can't get enough of that social capital and that educational infrastructure in place that used to be there back when work was easy. A lathe was a lathe and a metal stamper was a metal stamper. You can get high school graduates to do those jobs. They need people who are coming out of their local education system who are good, well-rounded, intelligent, problem-solving citizens. And they, if you come to them with that proposal, I want to help you stay in business by making sure I don't want to produce drones. I don't want to produce mindless button pushers. I want to produce intelligent, thoughtful, problem-solving people who are good citizens and take an active interest in their community and are also can make you help you grow your business. Maybe even after a while, spin off a little business of their own based on what they've learned from you. There's a model for this, a model for all this stuff. That kind of if that kind of conversation is icky to you because socialism or because your ideology doesn't permit you to think in that way, then you on the liberal side are a problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You are cutting off your nose to spite your face. You're not differentiating between two things that require differentiation.
Well, and that's the thing. Employers need employees, and employees need to make a living wage.
And the idea that
employees need employers to hire them.
Yes.
And it's not as if we can. There are plenty of demons to demonize in the work world.
Making money is not evil.
No, but making money is not evil.
Making a profit is not evil. Running a business is not evil. Doing those in a
treating your employees as if they're drones or if
is
as
evil.
The lowest possible non-living wage is evil.
And doing it in a rapacious way is evil. Mm-hmm. But the whole idea that if, you know, you and I run a small business, it's this podcast.
It is.
We make a tiny revenue from it. The idea that
I realized the other day that I make as much off of this podcast, or we do, if I substitute taught one day a week for a whole day, that I would make the same amount of money as I make podcasting. So to me, that's like, that's about as much time as I would want to work outside the home, given my three kids and one special needs. And I have a lot of emphasis in my life on giving to church and working for my kids. And that's what I want to do.
We're job creators, Blue Gal. Dirty, a small business is not a dirty word. Yeah. The guy who runs your local restaurant, who serves you coffee, is a small business owner. Mm-hmm. He's not a monster. And if your ideology just puts everyone who makes money into the same pot and calls them all monsters, then you're either 12, in which case it's forgivable because you'll grow out of it, or you're the last communist in America, which is delightful. As the Pope says, Les
is going to get off his soapbox now, because this really is a soapbox for him. And we
it is. For as the Pope says, I know lots of nice Marxists.
Lots of nice Marxists.
They're lovely people.
I want to talk about baddish Bush syndrome.
Yeah.
As bad as Bush.
As bad as Bush. Maybe worse even.
Just as bad as Bush.
Now, we're going to mark this podcast 100% Glenn Greenwald free.
Okay, good.
Because this has nothing to do with
that. This doesn't have to do with that. It has to do with something else. It has to do with Barack Obama's lost year. Oh,
he did.
So very
did.
Sad. And
fifth year.
Fifth year was is as bad as any president has ever had. Except,
maybe worse.
You know, worse than Nixon.
Worse than Lincoln.
Lincoln had a pretty good fifth year until that play.
Until that bad moment.
Until he went up into the balcony and watched that play.
And that was then.
Then
that
fifth year turned very bad for him.
But right up until then, it was going really good.
Better than Obama's, let me tell you.
No, and this is simply a matter of observation. This is a matter of me stopping my job as booster of economics and populism and labor and small business. And going back to the putting my pundit hat back on and zooming way back to 60,000 feet and noticing how deeply invested so many of our conservative brothers and sisters are and our centrist brothers and sisters are in making the last year, painting it as a disaster for one person and one person only, Barack Obama. And when you read under that, specifically Ron Fournier in the National Journal and James Polos in the Daily Beast, both hitting the same topic at the same time. Although James Polos really, it was a thing of beauty to watch. Not that his writing was beautiful, but he pulled off what I now think of as the Wingnut Statue of Liberty play. Which is where he takes the snap. So here's the thing. The premise is the last year in Barack Obama's term, his fifth year, has been as bad as George Bush's fifth year, possibly worse, in ways that are remarkably similar, so similar that we should compare the two. Now, mind you, the whole point behind this exercise is to get you thinking Barack Obama's as bad as Bush. Why should we beat up on those conservatives for supporting Bush when Barack Obama really is probably just as bad? Maybe both sides do it. Maybe both sides are equally bad. Maybe a crappy website rollout is really as bad as Iraq and Katrina.
Or Watergate.
Or Vietnam. Maybe they're all pretty much bad, So, but Ron Fournier, his article, Ron Fournier's article was just ridiculous. It was just a work of pure wingnut fan fiction. It eliminated any reference to anything underlying the disaster that was the Bush administration. It overblew everything. It made some shit up. It lops some stuff off. It really forced the premise in much the same way that David Brooks invents things to support his premise. It's just fiction. He just made this shit up, but it gets published and it gets talked about and it becomes a thing we talk about at cocktail parties.
And the check always clears.
It always does. James Polos draws the conclusion that as bad as Bush, that's his thesis, as bad as Bush. And he goes, he builds up this entire, Barack Obama has this and Bush has that. And they both have these terrible things that happened. And of course, Bush had all these things happen. But then he goes to, let's go over to, everyone's talking about how wrong this is, except let's go over to talk to Gene Healy. Yeah, Gene Healy is the only guy he relies on. Gene Healy is a vice president of the Cato Institute.
Oh, wow.
Who wrote this long article based, as far as I can tell, entirely on right-wing talk radio talking points about Benghazi and the IRS scandal and one fucking crazy right-wing radio bullshit after another, piling them on top of each other to prove that Barack Obama has been a disaster and a tyrant and a commie fink and blah, 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 blah. So here's Cato. Cato Institute takes the snap from right-wing talk radio turns it into a think piece on what a commie tyrant Barack Obama is. Fades back to past, but no, he hands it off to James Polos, who runs around the other way and says, see, Barack Obama's a commie tyrant failure, and George Bush had Iraq, so basically they're both pretty bad.
Oh my God.
And he runs it into the centrist end zone for a touchdown.
Yeah.
And that's how you do it, boys and girls, and that's how you do it. I would note that Wikipedia told me that the Statue of Liberty play is very hard to pull off. You fumble a lot. It requires a lot of discipline. But they never contemplated the fact that the refs would work for one of the teams.
Oh.
So it doesn't really matter how many times you fumble the ball or how badly you fuck up, because the refs are always going to call it in your favor. Mm-hmm. So it was a thing of beauty to just watch him transform right-wing paranoid ravings into a white paper, into a sober and thoughtful comparison that gets published at the Daily Beast. Yep. This is a commentator at my, and the reason I know this guy's important is Details Magazine told me he was.
Wow.
Yeah. Last year they did a whole article on the young guns. The young pundits you should look out for. All the right, and Sippy Cup is in there.
Oh man.
And this guy's in there. And so forth. So it was wonderful to watch how grotesquely dishonest on so many different levels this is. But once it finally reaches print, unless you actually go look at where their sources are coming from, you couldn't really tell that these guys are lying right their ass off.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. I just want to point out, hat tip won't get, that The Wire, there's a place called thewire.com that has done an post that's getting a lot of attention. Mm-hmm. Easily the greatest collection of political gifts on the entire internet. And that one of them is free. Did you know that you can send a free e-card to your friends and relatives from the Heritage Foundation?
That would make them go that's for sure.
Featuring Sarah Palin standing in the snow with her Fidel Castro hat on.
Oh, that's nice.
You know what it doesn't mention except at the website that's listed at the bottom? You know what
Festivus?
Word isn't on there? No, Christmas. It's celebrate the season.
Oh, my.
It says on the Sarah Palin e-card. Why does she hate Christmas?
Why does she hate baby Jesus?
Why does Heritage Foundation hate Christmas?
I don't understand why these people hate Christmas so much. They can't bring themselves
to say it. I'm someone who would read Celebrate the Season and think they're talking about Christmas, so I'm not offended. But
I would too. I would think celibate for this season, but given her family's background, I would think that would be a little embarrassing.
That wouldn't work for her. Yeah. Her family doesn't do that.
No.
All right. One last thing. Uh-huh. We have a letter from one of our listeners named Helen, and this came in the post office box today.
Today.
Thank you for going to the post office box.
You're welcome. I had to push a lot of old ladies out of the way to get to the post office. But it was worth it because we got this letter from Helen.
Helen. And Helen is in New York State, and we're very grateful to her. She sent us a contribution, and thank you very much. Dear Driftglass and Blue Gal, I send this holiday gift to you and your children with a boatload of love and support, and also with a bit of embarrassment. You see, I have been listening to and reading you both for years, and I have been doing it for free, although once or twice I threw Driftglass a few shekels. But really, I have been lax, and for that I apologize. I have no excuse. My impetus for finally writing is that I have finally come to the realization that all you say is true, not politically, that is a given, but also personally. My background story is long and very different than most people, but the upshot is that I have finally ended a relationship with a cousin/friend that lasted close to 50 years. I have kept my mouth shut for too long. It was killing me inside. I tried to use your vocabulary, and for that I thank you. I am a New Yorker, and fuck is my favorite word, although oddly, it never helped me win an argument.
It never does.
Never does. So I finally asked my cousin in an email to help me understand the rights philosophy. I worded the question very carefully. No politics involved, I told her, but please tell me what you are thinking. And do you know what happened? Can you guess what happened, Driftglass? Guess the ending of this incident.
I think it ended well.
No.
The
vile, vindictive shit she wrote back was fascinating. It was also full of lies and incorrect information. Hey, did you guys know Obama bailed out the banks?
He did. It's true.
She is a true wingnut playing the victim game. The last victim straw was when she insulted my mother. According to her, I was way luckier than she was because when I was 12 years old, my mother died. That's right. A dead mother makes you strong.
Yeah.
And that is why I have been more successful than her.
Yeah.
I should count my lucky stars that my mother was not around to ruin my life.
Mm-hmm.
Which, according to my cousin, she most certainly would have.
Yeah, probably.
Okay, this sounds like a Rand Paul disciple.
Well, this sounds like a...
My dad was dead.
Yeah. Which Southern Gothic novelist wrote
really,
this?
Honestly. I am sorry, Helen. Believe me, I am sorry that this happened to you.
Yeah.
Driftglass is right. You cannot change these people's minds with numbers and stats and truth. I thought I could, but believe me, I gave all those stats to her in that email. She did not care. The stats were all fake. She lives in a world where whatever makes her feel better about herself and makes her feel better than the others is her truth.
Yeah.
I know her life. Her truth has nothing to do with reality. Still, my heart is broken at the loss of her. But further still, I am not sorry that I ended the relationship. It took all the strength I had, and the two of you helped me find that strength. There is polluted air, and there is clean air, and she is polluted air. I cannot breathe it anymore.
Yeah.
So I thank you for your truth and for all that you do, and have a lovely, lovely holiday. I send you loves and kisses and hopefully jobs.
Yay!
Signed, Helen. P.S. I wrote the check in Fran's name because I was not sure that you could cash a check written out to the professional left. Thank you, but yes, we can. Either way is fine, but and certainly we can deposit this in the right account and make sure it gets accounted for. But anyone that makes out a check to professional left, we have an account that will handle that. Either way, thank you very much, Helen.
Thank you, Helen.
Contributions really appreciated, and your letter is amazing. And yes, I am so sorry.
Yeah.
I'm really sorry. I understand where she's coming from. And it takes a lot of strength to do that. It really does.
It really, and I won't belabor the point, but I tuned in some of that polluted air.
You did.
On running errands today. Just spinning out for a couple of errands. Had to pick some stuff up and listen to Boss Rush Limbaugh, for 5 minutes. And it was all about how they hate America. They think they're America. They're not America. They're not Americans. The left is made up of academicians and pointy-headed communists who think they can run car companies and think they, but they've never done anything in their lives. They're lazy. They're dilettantes. That's why Pajama Boy, because they think America looks like that, but America doesn't look like that. And they keep interfering with your life, and they keep controlling things, and they keep taking things away from you. And then we're off to John Kerry land.
Yeah.
And what a fake hunter he is. And it's this horrid, constant barrage of identity politics, and how they, those people, those intellectuals, those college professors and academics and policy wonks who've never done a real job in their whole life. Says the guy who loads up his suitcase and takes sex holidays. It never stops. It's so consuming and toxic and self-contained that at some point you just have to step away from it. So I'm glad you could do that, Helen. I'm really sorry for your loss, but I'm glad you did it.
Each week we post to our Facebook page and website an internet kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's internet kitty is Turlo. Much like the Doctor Who character from whom he received his name, he's kind of a butt and enjoys clawing and biting, according to his servant. Not his master, his servant. I have to tell you, most of the cats that get sent to us are older cats, because people love their older cats and take pictures of them. This is a wee little kitten. It's a wee little orange kitten. And he's chewing and clawing and biting, you know, they'll grow out of that. But that cuteness, oh my goodness, it's worth looking at our Facebook page or our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com. You can send your internet kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, where you can also write to both of us. Feel free to write us. We love, 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 love hearing from you. And by the way, Helen's Christmas card is really fun. It's Dr. Zeus, the Who's down in Whoville, standing around the Christmas tree singing. So it's wonderful. Thank you. We love getting your cards and letters. And be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service. Go Postal Unions! Letter on the air, unless you say otherwise. So, Driftglass, how are the internet kitties doing this week?
Well, the internet kitties hope you're having a wonderful Christmas, which for them means your tree gets knocked over at least 3 times a day.
Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-doving. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with the switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
Professional Left Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license. Copyright 2013, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
Minecraft is awesome. Now it's time for Science Fiction University with our science fiction expert, Jif Glass.
All right. Hey, I've got some Science Fiction University questions for
you. Yay. All right. I have a Science Fiction University alternate plot that we'll use to transition into.
Oh, go right ahead.
But
are you going to do that now?
No, well, it's about David Brooks. So.
Oh, all right. Well, we'll get to David Brooks during the political part of the show.
Well, is David Brooks a Robert Heinlein character? That's my question.
Oh,
yes.
Why would he be up? That's science fiction. Why would he be a Robert Heinlein character?
Well, that's part of our political fiction. No.
Crossing the streams.
It will require a slightly longer explanation. So let's do the few of the questions and we'll come back to.
What's ironic about all of that is our listeners, if they listen to this in chronological order, will have already heard your David.
Yes. It's like time travel.
We do is record. Everybody knows this by now. We record Science Fiction University first to get ourselves warmed up, and then
you're breaking the fourth wall.
All right. Our wonderful friend Raymond, who sends us science fiction books and is just such a great guy.
Generous.
Hi, Raymond.
Thank you, Raymond. Hey, Raymond.
Christmas. Sent us some science fiction questions, and two of them are about Robert Heinlein's Double Star.
Okay.
I don't know when that was written, but is that a novel or a short story?
Short novel.
Short?
Short novel.
All right.
It's a novel, but, you know, these are thin. These are 120-page, 160-page, 50-page novels. Yeah.
All right. Well, there's a character in the Double Star called the Great Lorenzo.
Yes.
And he is hired to do a job. What is it?
Espionage of a kind. Some deep, covert activity.
All right. Raymond's a little more specific in his answer.
Uh-huh.
He says he had to take the place of the kidnapped politician Bonforte.
Oh, yeah.
To help make a treaty with the Martians.
Yeah.
So half a credit for that one.
Well, and that shows up a couple of times. There's a couple of cases of imposters and things. But yeah, and that's a good classic literature trope. That's the Prince and the Pauper.
Yes. It's a lot of books.
It's old. Heinlein stole from everybody, as we all do.
Question number two about Double Star is, while they're looking for Bonforte, the Great Lorenzo meets the Supreme Minister. And the Supreme Minister figures out that the Great Lorenzo isn't the real Bonforte. He figures it out almost immediately. How does the Supreme Minister know that this is an imposter?
Well, I don't know, but I'm going to say, just for laughs, that it's a lady, and she kisses him on the mouth and realizes immediately this is her husband or something like that.
All of a sudden it becomes a Mae West story, right?
Sure. Or Dave.
Yeah. Great Lorenzo disguised as Bonforte didn't insult the Supreme Minister's model railroad like the real Bonforte would have.
That rings a bell.
All right. And now for something completely different, let's talk about Hitchhiker's Guide.
There's
a character in one of the five books of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy named Wowbagger the Infinitely Prolonged. He is on a mission. What is it?
This I know. To insult every sentient being in the universe.
That's correct. In alphabetical order.
Oh, that's right. In alphabetical order. That's right. Which is tricky.
And what does he say to Arthur Dent the second time?
As I recall, he calls Arthur Dent a knee biter.
I don't remember that
which
part.
I thought was a very clever and odd insult, but that's all I know. That's all I remember. Such a knee biter, Dent.
Arthur Dent, the second time, Wowbagger the Infinitely Prolonged, looks at his clipboard and says, "I've done you before, haven't I?" All right. And in which newspaper, this is not Hitchhiker or Heinlein.
Oh, Jesus. That's all I know.
Which newspaper would you find The Truth Shall Make Ye Fret?
Oh.
Y-E-F-R-E-T. Fret. Ye fret.
Make ye fret. Well, The Truth Shall Make Ye Free is...
The Bible.
The Truth Shall Make Ye Fret. It sounds like something Spider Robinson would write.
Yeah, but it's not. It's not. From Discworld and...
Oh, okay.
Ankh-Morpork Times. So... On the Discworld.
Man, this is why we don't do Science Fiction University anymore. I faceplant. But you know what? I really do always learn something.
Yes.
I always
learn. Thank you for those questions. Send in more questions. Yeah. If you want them to be secret, you can send them to mrs.driftglass@gmail.com.
And while mrs.driftglass makes an excellent interlocutor, and she does, and she's very, very bright, and I love talking, the thing that is missing from this section, I think, this part of our show, is interactivity with the questioner.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it would be fun to have a call-in, wouldn't it?
This is the kind of thing you'd have in a con suite at 2 in the morning, arguing over, you know.
All right, well.
But
in my voluminous spare time, I will set up a call-in
so that people can
call in their questions and ask you.
No, it would have to be live.
And then you can become John Hodgman.
It would have to be live.
Well, that's what John Hodgman does on his wonderful podcast.
Well, John Hodgman, thank you very much for emasculating me right here on my own podcast. Maybe if you were like John Hodgman.
John Hodgman does that. You know, he has a
call-in. I know he does. He has a rocking good podcast, too.
He does. It's wonderful. All right. So thank you, everyone, and happy holidays. And we will be on next week. So see you then.
Would you like to hear about David Brooks now or later?
Later.
Okay.
Because we're going to start the podcast and do the whole thing right now.
All right.
So let's do it.